Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making us and government more responsible. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free to, from the USA, 877-876-5227, from Canada, 888-810-8322, or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, just contact us through bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. And you can read my own blog at howtheneocons stole freedom.blogspot.com. This week, my blog was titled Family Fascism, The Destruction of American Families. The story I told went into how families are ground up to provide an income for those who have, by device or by example, come to view all of us as their property. A little later, we will be exploring solutions to the problem with today's guest. He has a solution that gives all of us an out. Also, watch for my second blog of the week on the Bush fantasy film on 9/11. There are more stories than you realize in neo-conning land. And now, our update from New York and elsewhere. This week, the Times Union actually put out an editorial in New York on our favorite miscreant, Ada Smith, state senator. The story popped into my email box through the good offices of our New York correspondent, Doug Green, and here it is, the opinion of a paper in New York titled, Punishment for State Senator Ada Smith Seems as Lenient as It Seems Futile. So what's really changed in the long and tiring saga of State Senator Ada Smith? 6 months ago, Ms. Smith was arrested on charges of misdemeanor assault after a legislative aide accused the senator of throwing coffee in her face. Ms. Smith denied doing anything of the sort. 9 days ago, Ms. Smith was found guilty of the reduced charge of second-degree harassment, a criminal violation, not even a misdemeanor, by an Albany City Court judge. She again denied doing anything wrong. Quote, I still pledge to you this never happened, Ms. Smith said upon her conviction. Never in my life have I intentionally hurt anyone. What happens now, then, with the ever-defiant Ms. Smith, guilty of a low-level offense, fined a meager $250, and told to attend anger management classes? What will be any different back in the Senate, for instance, where Minority Leader David Patterson ought to be thoroughly exasperated with Ms. Smith by now? It's a bit of an understatement to say that her behavior has been called into question before. About 8 years ago, Ms. Smith was accused of biting a police officer as he tried to arrest her in Brooklyn. As recently as 2 years ago, Ms. Smith was convicted of disobeying a state police officer and speeding through a security checkpoint at the Empire State Plaza in Albany. By then, Mr. Patterson had had enough, or so it seemed at the time. He removed Ms. Smith as the chairwoman of the Senate Democratic Conference and took away the leadership stipend that bumped her Senate salary from $79,500 to $96,000. But then Mr. Patterson made Ms. Smith the Assistant Minority Leader for Policy and Administration. She was able to keep that extra $16,500 as well as a state car. It struck us at the time as an invitation to continue to behave badly. And now, we can't help but wonder what else Mr. Patterson or anyone else in the Senate leadership might have in mind to address an outright embarrassment to an institution that needs no more of them. Anger management classes for this woman? What a farce. What about anger management classes for her constituents back in Queens, in a district, by the way, where there have been rumblings that she doesn't even live there, as the law requires. If only someday voters will express anger in the most constructive of ways, by kicking Ms. Smith out of office. And that's the developments for Ms. Smith in New York. And now, developments continue with the ongoing expose of the cabal surrounding the persons of Edward H. Crane III and Howie Rich and their longtime friends. Find out more by visiting www.hartwilliams.com. Now that it is after Labor Day and all things political are heating up, reporters and people in the various states are struggling to understand why these astroturfers from elsewhere should be pumping in money to pass legislation in their states. Inquiries are therefore being pursued actively. What they are finding is only making them angrier. The AstroTurf flim-flam artists are now running operations in nearly half the states in the country. The most recent chapter in the Hart Williams saga on the AstroTurfers is titled Reportage on Perfidy Made Simple. You will be sure to appreciate Williams' wry sense of humor as he carves them up and buries them deeper than they ever imagined possible. The AstroTurfers will also be covered in my book, Politics for the Politically Clueless, but my stories will be far more embarrassing for them. Stay tuned. And now our thought for the week ahead. This week on A Spiritual Politician, we're going to be looking at a means for removing ourselves and our families from imminent danger. You may not even know that here in the United States, getting married and having kids makes you a potential victim. The system that spells danger for families is, and this will not be a surprise to anyone who's gone through a divorce or child custody, the family law system. The message sent through legislation, law, and the courts here in the United States speaks a message of savagery, control, and profit, forcing the flow of funds from the lives of Americans into the hands of those who are entrusted to ensure access to justice. Changing that is just one of the things we need to do to bring the tool of government into alignment with the spiritual mission given into our charge by Christ. The mission Christ left with us was love one another. Christ said, give and be to each other as you would give and be to me. It's hard to see how that message of love, coupled with ready help and compassion, squares with a message coming out of any agency of government today. But the family law system has arguably been among the worst of those. Just yesterday, a mother and father in Florida managed a stay of execution from their local court. That stay was on their rights to remain connected to their five children and to be recognized as their parents. What horrible thing did they do, you might ask, to have those children dragged from their home? Nothing that might not have happened to any of us. You can read more about their story on their website, www.rescuemykids.com. But here is part of that story from an article you'll find on that site. A couple of years ago, Greg's sister Diane had come to visit and brought her white German shepherd-like dog. They kept the dog outside, but Diane brought the dog inside to escape the rain. Greg had taken the three older children with him to run some errands. Melissa had lain their two-week-old baby on their large bed, left the room, and closed the door behind her. Greg's sister went into the bedroom a few minutes later to check on the baby, then left the bedroom door, leaving the door ajar. A few minutes later, Melissa went into the living room and found the baby lying on the rug, with the dog lying in front of the baby. The baby was not crying. Apparently, the dog had entered the bedroom, picked up the baby off the bed in its mouth, and carried it into the living room by its head, and stood watch beside it on the floor. It seemed to be a protective act, but the teeth had left punctured wounds in the newborn baby's skin. Melissa called 911 to get an ambulance over to make sure the baby was okay. She took the baby to the hospital. The hospital people called the Department of Children and Family. The DCF's investigator, Megan Gallagher, arrived, asked Greg and Melissa what had happened, wrote down the events, and informed them they would not be able to take their baby home. During the days that followed, DCF forcibly removed all of the children and put them in foster homes. The children have been taken to doctors 70 times since then. Now they suffer from neglect, ringworms, lice, and numerous other indications of abuse. Since the dog bite incident, Greg and Melissa followed the court's case plan mandated by Judge Marion Fleming in order to get their children back, but the court and DCF refused. The plan required the parents to attend domestic violence classes and to agree to instruct their children about homosexuality and masturbation, among other remedial steps to correct the family problems. According to Greg, the DCF and the judge both lied and misrepresented facts about them, in spite of the requirement of Chapter 39 of Florida statutes to find ways to keep the family together. Greg says Gallagher wrote an affidavit about them in which everything except their names and addresses was a lie. And he says the state has done everything and anything to try to destroy the family and make him and Melissa give up hope and abandon the children. When you visit the site, you'll be able to view a film showing many, many people from the same area telling their very similar experiences. The same agents and judges are nearly always involved. Similar stories told from the anguished mouths of thousands are now coming from all over the country. Government is the tool we, as Americans, decided to use to organize some parts of our lives. Why we are using government as a means for handling what is essentially a contract between individuals is a question that needs to be asked. That question goes all the way back to the close of the American Revolution and the failure to include women and blacks as people. Legislation was the only tool available to women who had been denied equal standing. Tonight you will hear Professor Stephen Sofranik, a Catholic father of seven, discuss how the present approach has failed and how using our churches and other organizing means, we can provide the stability and justice that all of us so desperately need today. Stephen Sofranik is a professor of law at the Ava Maria School of Law. He helped found the law school and has been involved in many other civic projects. He previously taught at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law and has taught a variety of classes to law students and attorneys. He has numerous publications and has been involved in public interest litigation for over a decade. The True Marriage Project, about which he will be talking, is an outgrowth of his interest in helping ensure that survival and growth of the institution most critical to society, the family. Professor Sofranik previously worked at one of the nation's largest and most prestigious law firms and clerked for Judge O. Scanlon on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth District. He is admitted to practice in Michigan and Illinois and has been admitted to practice before a variety of federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court. Please welcome Professor Stephen Sofranik. Steve, are you there?
Great to be with you, Melinda.
Yes, it's so nice that you could be with us this evening. Now, Steve, we always start the show with our guest by asking them to tell us something about themselves. Now, we know that you're married, you're Catholic, you're a law professor, and you have seven kids. So tell us some more about you.
What you want to know, like a fun fact that people might not generally expect, given what you've said about me?
Yes, it makes you sound so solid. Tell
yes.
us something fun about yourself.
I love to play basketball.
Whoa, that's fun.
Yeah, kind of a little different. Love to go camping, take my kids out, those sorts of things. So that's a little different.
That is. Basketball is something, of course, that a lot of people in the Midwest really do enjoy.
Yeah.
That's. I think it should be the state game of Indiana, though, right?
Right. That's what they say. Yeah. I play with a bunch of fellow older men regularly during lunch hour.
Well, that probably keeps you in shape, too, then.
Well, I hope I can claim that.
Well, that's
it's a lot of fun, if nothing else.
Yeah. And now, why don't you tell us about True Marriage and how that came into existence and how you became aware of the problems people and families face today?
Well, you know, obviously no one who lives in America today doesn't have some sense of the depth and the sort of gravity of the problem with regard to marriage. And I think I had begun to really seriously sort of investigate this area about a handful of years ago. And as I was doing so, you know, I was just struck at all of the information that sort of is regularly out there. And I started to put it together and organize it and try to analyze, you know, what's going on, why are we here, how did we get here, how bad is all this, where does it, take us. know, and how does this problem fit into a whole host of other problems? And that's really, really kind of how I got into it. It was originally from sort of a scholarly perspective, you know, what is the relationship between contract and merit, and, you know, how does it differ? How is it the same? How is this developed? And really, that's how I came to be interested in it. And then several years ago, I got an email from someone else, you know, in this sort of regular ladders of email. Someone forwarded an email from somebody who was looking for some constitutional help on a divorce case that they were involved in. And as the old adage says, no good deed goes unpunished. I said I'd help. And
so you just got sucked in, right?
That's where I am today. So it was really, I think, providential that I got the email, and I've been sort of at a much higher level of sort of interest and involvement ever since.
Mm-hmm. And that really is a problem today. You look at one little thing and you think, well, surely this is a deviation, this isn't the rule, and then you get into it and you realize it really is the rule.
It is the rule. You know, I would say this, that there is no greater social and probably, as a consequence, economic problem that America faces today.
Mm-hmm.
The destruction of the family, especially any concept of sort of a long-time commitment between a man and a woman, is just destroying this whole concept of marriage. And and as a consequence, we're facing a fallout that is taking place in many ways, right? I mean, we have a lot of problems with the children as they become adults, the adults who choose to do it in the first place. So there's just so many levels on which this works, and we're all facing it. You know, as a father of seven children, I think about this all the time.
Mm-hmm. You must.
Yeah.
So you have seven kids, and you think about what it's going to eventually cost them, and you look at maybe getting into a bad relationship, and you realize how really frightening that is.
Exactly. You know, just knowing that, so much of what we learn and who we are is who our parents were and how we were raised. I always joke about this with my students, saying that, you know, you and I may disagree on the war in Iraq. We may disagree on, you know, the economy and these sorts of things, and we still may get along pretty well. But if you think that we should have a duck for Thanksgiving and I think it's turkey, you and I might not talk to each other anymore. And, you know, a lot of who we are is somewhat non-reflexive and non-rational. You know, it just is. That's who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And how one has been raised is going to impact how one thinks marriage works and how raising children works, et cetera. And so as I think, you know, what's the likelihood that my children will be involved with and may marry someone whose parents have gone through this, and the person is suffering as a consequence, and maybe your children don't recognize it as much as they should when they're young. And, you know, it's just sort of an epidemic running across our society.
And if you throw government into that mix with the things that it enables in this particular case, so that's even more frightening.
Absolutely. I mean, what we have today is a Soviet-esque style of marriage management. You know, the government gives us one size fits all, and nobody can fit into it, and that's what we have. It's a one-size-fits-all. Everybody has a no-fault marriage in America, and like it or not, that's what you have, and whatever you have, you know, that's going to norm your society, and that's what we have today with essentially the government determining how one can invest in one's own marriage.
When did that really strike you? Was there a particular case that you looked at and said, my gosh, this is what's going on?
Well, you know, I had some sense of it. You know, the no-fault system really is devastating. And I guess at a certain level, I knew it and agreed with it and had some sense of it for many years. And then 5 years ago, I'd say I kind of got a little better sense of it. But when I spent 2 weeks in a trial in Ohio on a contested divorce involving the custody and care of four children, every negative statement ever made to me about the divorce system proved true.
So that must have been a very illuminating thing when you saw how this was going to impact real people and in ways that they never anticipated when they got into the relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely devastating. And to watch essentially a family be destroyed in a two-week trial was one of the most draining experiences I have ever undergone. You know, and so I really can't imagine, you know, how the actual, you know, people who were most affected by it were going through it. And me as a lawyer in the case and watching it all unfold and being part of it, I was just traumatized by it. In fact, I told people afterwards, when I would talk to people who knew I was down there, I'd say, you know, if you're married, you better go home to your spouse tonight, drop yourself at your spouse's feet, and say, if there's anything I've ever done, please forgive me.
Is that one thing you noticed, that all of these things were used as hammers in the case?
Yes. Yes. You know, and it's drummed up, and, you know, any particular context, you can say whatever you want, right? Because if somebody says just the opposite, the judge says, well, you know, you testified, and this other person testified. And so the consequence of it is that there's really no law in family law except, or I should say in this area of family law, except that the judges want to get these cases done as quickly as possible. And anybody who bucks the system is going to pay the price. And each judge has their own natural dispositions favoring, you know, one side a little bit more than the other.
Mm-hmm.
The law more or less says chop it up in half. And the judge is more or less going to do that with, you know, a little bit of this or a little bit of that, depending on how much of a stink you make about it.
And when you say chop it up in half, what you're really talking about is simply the assets that happen to be on the table at the time. No consideration is actually given for investments made in the relationship.
Zero. Everything is deemed to have been equal. No matter what the evidence is, just is the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Except they do make exceptions to that sometimes, so that somebody could actually bring assets into a relationship, and, you know, because of the legislation, those things will be kept separate, while something else that the two might have deemed as equal is then, you know, supposed to be common.
Yes.
And that almost always, you know, harms the what you'd think of as the innocent party, the person that doesn't want to get out of the relationship.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the innocent party, the person who has put the most into the relationship from any standard is the one hurt the most.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The more you've put in, and the longer you've been in it, and the less you were really planning on getting out, the more you're harmed, because the other person can be negotiating in a whole different way. And really, it's a classic situation where, you know, if you have two people who have radically different views of the relationship, one of the people would say, hey, they never negotiated in good faith over this.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's true. From that person's perspective, it really is true. But the other person says, well, you know, I negotiated from the perspective that the law allows me,
mm-hmm.
which is I can walk away anytime I want.
Right. And so that's the reality. And people climb into relationships, into marriage, thinking it's one thing, and then it's a bait and switch. It's actually something else.
Yes.
And there isn't even in advance, like you would for most contracts, they would have to tell you absolutely what the contract says and what it means. And in this case, it can actually be changed even after you sign the contract
by
the legislature.
Yeah. No, that's what happened to all the marriages as a consequence of no fault. You know, people had entered marriage with a radically different notion, and then with the advent of no fault, all of these marriages were turned into no fault marriages.
Now, let me ask you a question that I think really goes to a point here. What would American business be like today if business contracts were on this basis?
We would probably look like the Soviet Union. You know, it's the same sort of thing. The government runs it all. The government tells you what the results are going to be. You're stuck in the government courts. No matter what you want to do to sort of negotiate around it, you're stuck. You know, there can be some small, you know, exceptions to it, just as there were in the Soviet Union, sort of the black market that exists out there. But for the most part, you would have an economic system that looked a lot like the Soviet Union did.
Mm-hmm. So when you said we have a Soviet system in terms of marriage law and family law, that's really what you mean.
Oh, absolutely.
That means that we have a Soviet system, and of course the Soviet system was a fascist system.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
We have a centralized perception of a centralized ownership of children, which is another thing that the state uses to manipulate families, that you find out when you're in one of these situations like this happened with the Pounds in Florida, that they don't own the right to raise their children. That's something owned by the state of Florida.
Yes. The state has this term called the best interests of the children. And whenever a party enters divorce, the state then plays total claim to this, right? That they get to determine what's in the best interests of the children. And usually what that means is more or less, depending on the situation, chopping them up. They'll spend, you know, 4 nights with mom, 3 nights with dad. They'll alternate holidays, on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consequence of it is devastating. I tell my adult friends, can you imagine if you had to spend 3 nights in one house and 4 in another? You'd go crazy.
Yeah.
All your whole life, holidays switched around, back and forth. It would drive people insane. How many people travel half their days, you know, half the time they're on the road to some other place?
Mm-hmm.
When neither of them's home, you know. So it's just a devastating situation that we've created for our children.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was even reflecting on another aspect of this just the other day and thinking about holidays and, you know, how holidays and memories of holidays are kind of a real family thing. You know,
yeah, it creates a family culture and gives you stability in the future.
Exactly. And now think about that, where a holiday has actually become a matter of trauma for the child. Because remember, in a divorce situation, they kind of have to split this up. So the child knows that if I'm spending time with mom, I'm not spending time with dad.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm spending time with dad, I'm not spending time with mom. So Christmas this year is with dad, and Christmas next year is with mom. I mean, by its very nature, some of those great moments in our life are now, by their very nature, split.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's traumatic. It just, you know, when I was thinking about that, I said, you know, it is one of those sort of cultural aspects of being a child, is to have those holidays filled with, in a way, humorous, idiosyncratic, warm events.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
For these children, it'll never be.
Yes, they've completely lost that, and the same means for taking it away from them is, again, of course, the state contract. And what you're doing with true marriage actually is an alternative to that. It's a private means. In your particular case, mediated through the Catholic Church, but in other cases, it could be done through other religions, other institutions.
Yes.
So could you tell us a little bit about how you see that working?
Well, one of the things you have with regard to prenuptials today, and they're often looked down, you know, religious people often look down on them because they have historically been drafted by a wealthy, more powerful, and let's face it, generally a man, marrying a younger, less worn out woman, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what was done. And so as a consequence, courts would often say, this isn't right because, man, you want to keep 90% and woman gets 10, or you're keeping 99 and she's getting 5. That's not going to work. So a lot of these prenuptials, people were against them from a religious perspective because they said they anticipated divorce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they kind of created this divorce culture. What I'm proposing is actually just the opposite, and that is, instead of determining that the property will be split 95-5, it says, no. The determinations will be made in accordance with your faith tradition, by people in that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever that is, and even if it's none, you could even lay out, you know, some ground rules to deal with it. And then to have people who will make the evaluation based upon that faith tradition or that view of life, those principles. And as a consequence, since the money is not predefined as going mostly to X and, you know, very little to Y, it's really a procedural means to facilitate people actually living out their life in a faithful way.
Mm-hmm.
Because now people know that under my faith tradition, if you're not faithful, that's going to create trouble for you.
Because what you do is you create a liability. You create accountability in marriage.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's so important, because if our kids don't see that they need to do the right thing, how are they ever going to live that out in any other part of their lives?
Yes. And why not in the most important relationship you will ever have?
Mm-hmm.
One of my little thoughts on this was, I was going to write my first article. I've changed a little bit on this, but it was going to be called Marriage, Priceless: Worthless.
Oh, I like that.
You know, because, it, you know, on the one hand, we treat it in some ways this priceless thing, but when it comes right down to it, from the state's perspective, it's a relatively worthless thing. So, we have all these strange inconsistencies in the whole marriage system, and if we had a more rational and organized system that was consistent with human nature,
mm-hmm.
and what we, the type of beings we are and what is necessary in order to properly have a society and to allow families to flourish, then we'd be okay. But right now we've got a system that has all these chopped up inconsistencies in it, and I think we need to try to relook at this and go back to some things that had existed before with regard to how we viewed this, and then now how are we going to treat it in the modern legal structure that we have. And my proposal here is a ambitious one, but it is in many ways it's a very modest one, and that is, let's let people fulfill the promises that they made.
Yes, and you also propose a mediation system.
Yes.
So that when people run into, as they inevitably will, disagreements, there's a way so that they don't have to just dump the marriage. What they can do is work through the marriage and make it work.
That's exactly right. I think one of the major issues you face today is that whenever anybody has marital troubles, if you go to a lawyer, especially a lawyer who's involved in divorces, and there are many of them out there, and I don't want to implicate every lawyer and all this. There are many fine ones out there, but many, many, many of them, the first thing they want to do is they are thinking about your interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're paid to do, is to think about your interest in a very narrow way, because now you've told them it's your interest against this other's interest. And so consequently, they're going to tell you to do everything you can to protect your interests, which means, you know, to extricate yourself from this situation in a way that's most favorable to you. And that's their interest to serve your interest,
mm-hmm.
or what, you know, is seen as your interest as a matter of law. And so at the very beginning, lawyers have an incentive to actually encourage you to fulfill this movement, which is to get a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to do is do just the opposite, to actually tell people, you know, it's not quite this way, but, you know, to give them a good dressing down and to say, you know, what's going on here? What'd you commit to? What is the situation? How can we mediate this? What type of help do you need, and how can we help you find it?
Mm-hmm. So there's two things here, really, essentially. There's the true marriage system, where people would move into this consciously and go through, you know, a set of protocols so that they would understand the contract that they were making, and they would negotiate each portion of it and then sign off, like check, 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 like when you're buying a piece of real estate, but making sure you're reading it thoroughly.
That's exactly right.
And then you have a sort of the retrofit system, where what do we do about already existing marriages?
Yes.
Which must be much more troublesome and to you.
Yes.
Because
yes, I think the same thing, though, that can happen in those marriages, they can also agree to these things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, many people, and again, the beauty of my system is nobody's promising property to anybody, right? There's no splitting of assets. This is going to be determined in accordance with these principles.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually has a much greater likelihood of succeeding in the courts, because I'm not trying to, you know, mistreat anyone. In fact, what we're trying to do is treat everybody according to the promises that they made.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually a much more fair system, and so people who keep their promises will be rewarded, and people who break their promises won't be, which is a simple principle of justice.
Well, absolutely. And what sort of means for mediation if a marriage is in trouble do you imagine?
Well, what I imagine is that we will develop means to for people to come on in. And I think one of the things you really need to do is you got to separate husband and wife. And it's probably best that husband and wife talk to both a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talk to each of them separately. And let's face it, men and women do have different views of things in many ways. We have different perspectives. We have different things, just as all of us do, but even more so between men and women. And I think this intake process is to try to then get a sense of what the real issues are in this marriage and then find them the appropriate people who can give them, if they need more treatment, right, they need more help, if they need
mm-hmm.
serious help, to try to get that. If they need less, maybe less, if it's a particular issue, to see how that can be dealt with. So, you know, what I'm really hoping is that this becomes actually a comprehensive marriage plan for our society.
Mm-hmm.
I envision it in part in this way. I kind of have one of these ideas that we should certainly in the churches call May Marriage Month.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's the month when, you know, marriages really start picking up for the whole summer, spring season.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are married from May through September. And to use that whole month, especially in our churches, to make sure people know what marriage is about, you know, to talk about that, what is the commitment, so that everybody knows and is thinking about it, and to have discussions and serious sort of meetings at parishes and communities where people actually hear from master couples, you know, couples who faced problems and how they dealt with them and how these things can affect lives and what we do and
mm-hmm.
those sorts of things. So to really develop a comprehensive program where we are helping people from the beginning understand what marriage is about, when problems arise, how do we meet them, when the problems become insurmountable, how do we resolve them? And when, after we resolve them, how do we comfort those who, despite all the best efforts, now find themselves in a very unpleasant situation?
It'll be much less unpleasant for them if there has been a contract that's actually enforceable.
Yes.
So that at least they're not looking at becoming poverty-stricken and losing their children on top of everything else.
Yes. I think that that's exactly right. We will, you know, there's no way you can fully compensate someone, right, for the trauma that takes place in a real marriage. You know, a marriage where truly one of the persons said, you know, I'm committed to this marriage and I'm going to live out my vows. And that person can never fully be made whole, but they certainly can be made less unwhole, which
mm-hmm.
is what happens today. And so what we want to do is at least balance the scales more, and their thereby, I think, encourage more wholesome marriage behaviors, marriage patterns.
Mm-hmm. And what are you doing in this regard? It sounds like what you're talking about should probably start when kids are pretty young, so that I don't know how many people still do this, but when I was young, one of the things that you got was you got a box to put things that you were going to use for your marriage in. It was your hope chest.
Yes.
And if you gave a girl a book about marriage and she went to some classes about marriage and she was able to talk to people about what marriage meant, and I'm certainly not talking about at school, I'm talking about at her church or at a community organization, I think that could make a tremendous difference, because she probably wouldn't have some of the visions of marriage that she grows up with today.
Sure.
Because we tend to romanticize it, and we think that things are going to work out just perfectly because we want them to, and that's how it was in the book or the movie.
Yes.
When, of course, it doesn't work out that way at all.
Yes. Yes, although I think, today we're in this completely schizophrenic mentality, right? We still have this incredible natural yearning for those movies where there's a beautiful relationship and it's a beautiful, situation, right? I mean, who cannot be attracted to those sorts of things? They're powerful, and we're still attracted to them. On the other hand, I think that many of the kids who are growing up today, and the studies show this, and obviously their marriage patterns show it too, and that is that they are actually unwilling and uninterested in committing to marriage because they have seen the reality out there in droves.
Mm-hmm.
So what we really have done is create a society in which many don't commit to marriage, won't commit to marriage, because of the situation that they've seen and the what they think they'll find themselves, in.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've taken to do ever since I became interested in this is I do a fair amount of sort of just going through blogs where people are putting information out that are kind of just personal blogs, where a person is just totally, and looking at comments and everything. And one of the things that I see repeatedly, again and again and again, is just this sense from so many of these about why I wouldn't be involved in getting married. How senseless it is. I just had another friend who got married and then got divorced, and I knew this and that, and now I know why I shouldn't get married. And
mm-hmm.
and so there's this, I think, a very powerful thrust in our society, where in a way you have these people who have been so damaged by the carnage they see around them.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well,
I mean,
we
who
see
wouldn't
the costs,
be?
And the cost wouldn't be there, as flawed as marriage ever was, without the involvement of government in the way that it's manipulated the law to its own benefit and the benefit of the courts.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And getting out of that is going to be a complex series of different issues. It's not one thing.
That's right.
But you've hit on something with true marriage that allows people to go in and actually, without any legislation, have a different kind of marriage, make sure that it's going to be understood to be that, and it's an enforceable contract.
That's exactly right. What I encourage everyone to take it into their own hands to the degree possible, and get themselves out of the state system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing worse than the state system. Unless, of course, when you marry, you just mean to have a Vegas marriage. If you want a Vegas marriage, the no-fault system is probably as good as any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want anything else, if you want to invest it all in your marriage, you need to do everything you can to make sure that you're not involved in the state system.
Now, that's an interesting phrase that you used, invest in marriage. And you said something else earlier that I thought was just very profound. Instead of having it be a 50-50 contract, what you want is to have a 100-100 contract. So both parties are looking at it, and they're giving everything to the relationship and not having any reservations about it. So there has to be an enormous trust there. And what you're talking about with true marriage creates the foundation for trust.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's an amazing thing that our legal system, by its very nature, encourages you not to trust, not to commit, not to be involved in your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever you invest in that will be considered really nothing. No matter how much you've invested, you're going to be considered to essentially be a 50% partner in all of the assets of that marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So if you invest in a way, you open yourself up to being hurt, right? You open yourself up to it, and the consequence is that people decreasingly then are willing to invest, and as a consequence, there's then a greater likelihood that their marriage won't succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So the very structure that we have created is helping to accelerate the divorce problem that we have.
Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, a horrific image for any of us when we see what happens in marriage today. What advice would you give to people who either want to advise their children about what they should do and what they should be aware of, or for themselves? What can individuals do? Is there a way that they can get active through your organization?
Yes, we have a website, truemarriage.net. It's one word, truemarriage.net. Pretty easy to find on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go there, and we have lots of information. I'm right now in the process of even updating the website in sort of a dramatic way, but that's going to be a month, maybe 6 weeks out still. But we've got a lot of information at the site. And if you can't find something there, send me an email and we'll see what else we can do to add it. I'm trying to make it as robust a site as possible so that it can serve people really across the country and hopefully across the world over time with regard to this issue. So that's where we are, and you can find us there.
And you're going to be coming up with materials that will enable people to do what we just talked about.
Yes.
So that they're going to be able to think about the issues, train their children on the issues, understand the mediation and the contractual obligations that they're undertaking and what those really mean. And certainly understanding the mediation aspect of it would mean that they would want to know in advance who was going to be mediating it, because that could be pretty scary.
Yes, I think that that's a very important thing. In fact, what one of the updates on my site is to start an intake of people who can serve for us as mediators in these matters. So really what we're trying to do is now set up a structure where we can at least begin to intake and trying to figure out ways in which we can check the authenticity and the credibility and other things with regard to the people who sign up. So it's an ambitious project.
It is.
And but there is no greater need, as far as I can see, in America than the need for this. And so we're working on it, and we're making movement forward and a little bit fits and starts here, but we are moving forward, and obviously we'd like people to visit our site, and if they like what they see and they want to see more of it, well, send me an email, and there's a donation page on there too.
That's always a good thing to keep in mind. And one other thing, this is not a thing of men versus women, is it? It's a right versus wrong.
Yes, you know, it's one of these sad things of modern life that as a consequence of the divorce system, that you have this huge degree of animosity between the sexes, you know, in one category or another. There's lots of men's groups that are anti-women, and there's lots of women groups that are anti-men, and vice versa. And that's not what this is all is about at all. I can understand how people have been harmed in the divorce process. You and I have spoken before, and one of the things I told you is that I never tell people that I'm a lawyer. And it's not because of lawyer jokes or anything else. It's because when I used to tell people that, in social settings, I would invariably get a just diatribe about lawyers as a consequence of a divorce that somebody in the group had gone through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an unpleasant thing. And so you can see how you have these angry people, and they're angry because they think that the judicial system hammered them. and it's a man or it's a woman, and they say, well, you know, the judges go with X, Y, or Z, or my ex had a better lawyer, and, you know, the lawyers are all in cahoots against women, or, you know, the judges are against the men, or, and there's all these sorts of things out there. And it's a, it has created this huge men-woman fight. And my view is that in order to have a family, you need a man and a woman working as a union.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing everything we can to foster that. And that's what true marriage is all about.
Amen. Well, Steve, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. What you have to say has been fascinating. And I hope that many people get in touch with you as a result of this. And you have a wonderful weekend with your family.
Thank you very much, Melinda. Looks like it's going to be a wonderful weekend here in Ann Arbor, so I will enjoy it.
Okay, that's good. Great. God bless.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Good night. And that's our show for today, Friday, September 8th, 2006. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to unify our spiritual natures with the material world in which we live. Government is the unifying principle that we use for organizing, but it's just a tool we've mandated to handle just a portion of our lives. Where it works, we should continue to use it. Where it causes harm, we should change it. It's up to us to make sure government is used appropriately. Most importantly, it's up to us, the people, to use persuasion, never deceit, coercion, never violence, in every relationship, including those we delegate to government. That was a message Christ left with us. It is a message each of us must send out to our own lives. To enact change, we need more good, dedicated people like Stephen Sofranik, willing to stand up for the right thing. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.